You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor of the New Republic, senior fellow at Demos, about the case of the century. Previewing the issues and the implications of the three-day oral arguments that will start next week at the Supreme Court in regards to the Affordable Care Act. This case could have massive implications, really, in any way that it is resolved. We will be discussing that with Jonathan Cohn. Also on the program today, we got a GOP primary in Illinois. That's probably all I'll say about it. Paul Ryan's coming out with his budget. Sure to please if you want the 1% to get some tax breaks and the rest of us to get stiffed on things like Medicare. Also on the program today, Apple still whining that they can't bring back their billions of dollars to this country without having to pay tax on it. And a wonderful, heartwarming story of a small entrepreneur selling she doesn't think it's racist, but don't renege in 2012. Wonderful. Before we get into all of that, an update on the Trayvon Martin killing that occurred now 3 weeks ago in just outside of Orlando. The U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division and the FBI is going to step in and investigate the killing of Trayvon Martin. This is coming after Governor Rick Scott of Florida asked the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to offer appropriate resources in the case. It's not only are they going to need, in terms of resources, as far as I can tell, handcuffs for Trayvon Martin's killer, this guy who had started his own neighborhood watch. And it's only fair. You start your own and you're the only person on it. You should make yourself the captain. A guy apparently now who it's come out that he had repeated calls to 9/11. And he apparently, again, apparently lied to police as to what took place when he got out of his car to supposedly just check and see where he was so that he could report the presence of a 17-year-old black kid in this gated community. It has now come out that Trayvon Martin was on the phone, on a cell phone, as this guy Zimmerman was pursuing him. ABC reports that it is confirmed by phone logs that Trayvon Martin, at the very least, was on the phone to a girl, a friend of his. And Martin's friend said, quote, "He said this man was watching him, so he put his hoodie on He said he lost the man. I asked Trayvon to run. He said he was going to walk fast. I told him to run, but he said he was not going to run. Eventually, he did run, said the girl, thinking that he had managed to escape this guy who was following him for some reason. But suddenly, the strange man was back, cornering Martin. Trayvon said, "What are you following me for?" And the man said, "What are you doing here?" The next thing I hear is somebody pushing, and somebody pushed Trayvon because his headset just fell. Now, George Zimmerman, Martin's killer, told the police that, quote, he had stepped out of his truck to check the name of the street he was on when Trayvon attacked him from behind as he walked back to his truck. And, of course, a lot of this deals with the notion of Florida's Stand Your Ground bill. But the thing that's amazing here is apparently the police not only didn't seem to question Zimmerman's account whatsoever, even though they had their own 9/11 dispatch recording, which suggested that the dispatcher thought that Zimmerman was at least running towards Trayvon Martin. But also, apparently, they did not bother to even check Trayvon Martin's cell phone to determine who he was or who he may have been on the phone with at that time, which seems to me the most rudimentary thing you would have done. To the point where when they put him in the morgue, he was John Doe and had to wait for Trayvon Martin's father to call to ID this guy. So it doesn't even appear that the police did any investigation whatsoever. So as far as I can tell, the DOJ and the FBI can't get down there fast enough because it's clear there's something wrong in this police department. And apparently there's been a record of it. The police chief's son apparently hit a coming out of a bar, punched a homeless black guy, and that whole thing was just dropped. So I don't know what's going on down there, but it's good that the FBI and the Department of Justice is on this. This story is going to continue to unfold. Right now, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jonathan Cohn. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the show Jonathan Cohn. He is a senior editor of the New Republic and a senior fellow at Demos. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on.
All right, let's talk about this. Next week we have the 3 days, I believe, of oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court regarding the Affordable Care Act, and this is 3 days is pretty big deal, isn't it? I mean, it's not generally this long, oral arguments.
Oh yeah, no, this is an unusual circumstance. They are taking this very seriously. They have called for hearings over many hours, and you know they've divided it up into the different parts of the case. So there's a chance to hear arguments. You know, about is the mandate constitutional? There's a whole set of arguments about what Medicaid, you know, whether the Medicaid expansion is coercive to the states. They are clearly, they recognize how important this case is, and they're giving it, you know, the time they think it deserves.
Now, there are three or four questions here. One is whether or not the mandate is constitutional. One is whether or not they're standing. In other words, if plaintiffs can come in front of the case and fight the Affordable Care Act, the issues of which have not yet been, imposed upon them as of yet, because all of the issues here, the mandate and the expansion of Medicaid, don't kick in until 2014. Then the issue of severability, and then this expansion of Medicaid. Let's take the expansion of Medicaid first, because this, to me, is sort of the strangest aspect of this case.
Yeah, it's a very strange aspect. And, you know, I think it's the part of the case that I think most mainstream legal scholars, when they heard that people were going to sue over this, they sort of did a double take and said, you know, seriously, you're going to sue over this? You know, the basic gist here is the lawsuit claims that by expanding Medicaid, which is the health insurance program for people who are low income, both working age people use it for their basic insurance, and then the elderly use it as supplemental coverage for their Medicare, and it also so a huge number of people use it to cover nursing home care. So the Affordable Care Act expands Medicaid tremendously, but Medicaid, in order to expand it, the states have to kick in a little bit of the money, and they have to operate the program according to federal guidelines. And the states are basically saying in this lawsuit, that's not fair, that's coercive, you can't basically force us to, you basically have us over a barrel. We depend upon this Medicaid money, and you're not giving us enough flexibility on how to run it, so we have no choice but to accept it, but now you're making us implement the law the way you like it. You're making us pony up our own funds for it, and that's not fair.
And the funds that they're ponying up are relatively small. I mean, I think at least in the first 3 years, the federal government provides 90% of the funding. The state makes up another 10%. And there's some, sort of policy debate as to whether or not, in the end, this will end up saving the state's money in some respect, right? I mean, because the more people you have covered under Medicaid, they're getting preventative care, theoretically, that's going to help down the road.
I mean, it's a fantastic deal for the states. I mean, the federal government is taking, as you say, you know, going to be basically soaking, you know, bearing almost the entire cost of this. States would be nuts not to take this money. And remember, I mean, if they don't take the money, you know, if they don't take Medicaid money, and then they're going to have to find some other way of taking care of the poor within their borders on their own. This is the best possible deal for them. So it's sort of policy lunacy to want to turn this away. But, you know, states, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it too. I mean, the reason the program is structured this way, the federal government is basically saying, look, we realize this is a big, it costs a lot of money to provide Medicaid. We understand that. We're going to give you most of the money. But look, in exchange, you have to do certain things. I mean, you have to give people real insurance, and you have to run the program well. And yes, you're going to have to provide some of your own money. The federal government is saying, look, we feel like this is a fair deal. You know, we're giving you all this money. We want you to pony up just a little bit and run the program in a competent way. And the states are basically saying, no. We just want you to hand us the money with no strings attached.
I know you're not. I mean, your expertise obviously is in healthcare policy, but you know, there's so many precedents that even someone like myself can point to. You know, just the federal highway funds occurs to me just because that happened when I was turning, I think, 18, and I suddenly realized I wasn't going to be able to drink for a couple of years. Why do you think the court took this case? I mean, they didn't have to take this element of it. It seems to me this is fairly settled law. Why do you think they took this case?
Well, and that's what's alarming about it. I think a lot of us thought that this was settled law. Certainly the law professors I know all thought this was settled law. And, the government makes the argument correctly, I think, that if somehow the Supreme Court were to throw out this Medicaid expansion, they would put in peril a whole bunch of other programs, education programs, highway funding, not to mention Medicaid as it exists already. I mean, this is how Medicaid has always been run. So if the federal government wants to, if the Supreme Court decides this is unconstitutional, it's basically going to redesign the entire federal-state relationship over through all sorts of policies. And I'm honestly quite surprised. I will tell you, I mean, I think most people who watch the court think of all the parts of the lawsuit, this is the least likely to succeed. I mean, there was a survey just out where the American Bar Association surveyed, you know, a panel of legal experts, and I think like 90% of them thought that the court would uphold this. So, you know, maybe the Supreme Court just felt like, well, we're doing this case, let's hear this, let's just get it out there. Hopefully that, you know, maybe let's give it a serious hearing just to be thorough. I hope that's what they're doing. But, you know, it does make you wonder, what's going on here? Are they really thinking about this? Because if they did, that would be an enormously radical thing to do.
All right, so let's go to let's move to the first aspect of, or the most prominent, I guess, is the constitutionality of the mandate. Now, just for the sake of our audience, just explain to people why the mandate is so crucial to the Affordable Care Act in terms of it being able to function. And aside from maybe the political implications as to why it was adopted.
Sure. Well, you know, if you think about what is the point of health care reform, one of the primary goals, right, is to make sure that anybody can get health insurance. You know, even if you have diabetes, even if you're a cancer survivor, if you have allergies, you know, today, if you have any of those pre-existing conditions and you on your own try to buy health insurance, insurance company won't sell it to you because they don't want to take people with pre-existing conditions. Or they may charge you a lot, you know, much more money, or they might give you a policy that doesn't cover, you know, complications related to your illness. So what this law does, the Affordable Care Act, it tells insurance companies, all right, no more. You know, you have to give everybody, if somebody's willing to pay for the insurance, you have to give it to them. You can't exclude them. You can't charge them extra rates just because they have a pre-existing condition. The problem is if you do that, and insurance companies will say this, and they happen to be right about it, they'll say, well, that's great, but now what's going to happen is everyone's going to wait till they get sick and then buy insurance, right? I mean, because why would you pay the premiums while you're healthy? Just wait till you get sick, and then you go out and buy insurance. So if you're going to require the insurers to sell to everybody regardless of pre-existing condition, you have to make sure people actually get insurance. And, of course, then you also have to offer financial assistance to people who can't afford it, which is why the law gets so expensive. But this is why you need this requirement. This is why you need this mandate. And, you know, it's been proven to work. You know, the one state that has tried to do health care reform on its own and got it right is Massachusetts. You know, they have 98% plus now with health insurance, which is by far the highest of any state, and premiums there are stable. They're not rising faster than the national average. In fact, in the part of the market they reformed, actually they're rising more slowly than the national average. So that's the policy justification. And in addition to that, when people, you know, we all know what happens when people don't have insurance. Well, they still get sick, right? So, you know, they end up at the emergency room. They get, you know, and hospitals are required to give people care when they show up if they need urgent care. And then, you know, usually they can't pay the bill, so then the hospital has to eat the cost. So what does the hospital do when it's, you know, giving out $50,000 of treatment to someone who has no way to pay it? Well, they pass it on to the rest of us in the form of higher insurance premiums, or, you know, they charge more, they manage to push through the Medicare system, which we pay with our taxes. So the idea of the mandate is both to sort of make the insurance market work, but also to stop what's called this sort of cost-shifting free rider problem. And basically it says, look, if there are people out there who can afford to pay for their health insurance, they should. And that's, you know, that's the policy justification for the mandate.
And the federal government, from a legal standpoint, is arguing that the government has the power to regulate interstate commerce under the Commerce Clause. Just break that down for us, because this is the most renowned argument that those opponents of the law will be arguing, is that someone not buying insurance does not constitute economic activity, and therefore they're not engaged in interstate commerce.
Right. So there's actually three separate justifications the government makes, and it really has to win on only one of them to win the case. But the central one, the one that I think most people are familiar with, is the one you just mentioned, which is we all know the federal government has the power to regulate interstate commerce. So does requiring people to either, you know, get insurance or pay a penalty if they don't, is that a form of regulating commerce? Now, the critics, as you say, no, that's not fair. You know, when someone decides not to get health insurance, they are not engaging in commerce. It's not a form of activity, they say, and they draw this distinction. They say the government has the right to regulate activity, but it cannot regulate inactivity. And this is inactivity. So, and if someone is choosing not to be in the health, you know, not to buy health insurance, in effect, they're choosing not to be part of the healthcare market, and the government has no right to regulate how they pay for health care. The counter argument is that, well, that would be fine if you didn't get sick ever. The problem is everybody gets sick. Everybody's going to show up at the hospital at some point. So when you're making that decision, you actually are making an economic decision. You are that is a form of activity. You are choosing not to prepare for the bills that you're inevitably going to get, and that's going to affect everybody else. It's going, again, you know, because of your decision, it's going to be harder for the government to make insurance available to everybody else, and it's going to be harder to make sure that, you know, we can pay for care for everyone, because you're going to have all these people showing up, you know, requiring charity care. So the government's argument, which I would agree with, is that, in fact, you know, actually when you decide not to get health insurance when you have the money to do it, well, that is a decision. That is activity. And it's totally reasonable for the government to say, you're going to consume this health care. Everybody does. And so we are going to tell you that you need to sort of make a payment plan so that when that time comes, you have a way to pay for it. And that way we can have a more stable, more affordable health care system.
And, in fact, this is what the Sixth Circuit found last summer when they reviewed this case on the appellate level.
Well, that's right. It's been a very interesting pattern. You know, more than a dozen cases were filed. And actually, people forget this. The vast majority of cases that were filed, either the courts refused to hear the case or upheld the law. But two lower courts ruled that the law was unconstitutional. Then it was appealed up to the circuit level. And it went through a number of appeals courts hearings. And the pattern almost entirely was, in general, more liberal judges tended to find it constitutional, and less, you know, more conservative judges tended to rule the law was unconstitutional. That pattern broke once you got to the circuit level, because two conservative judges, two very, very well-respected, two very prominent conservative judges, Judge Sutton and Judge Silberman, both ruled that actually the liberals are right, and that, you know, that the administration is right, and that this law is constitutional. And the decision by Silberman in particular was just a stinging smackdown. I mean, it was not ambiguous. I mean, this is Silberman. This is somebody who was awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Bush. He's an icon among conservative jurists, and he just looked at this case and said, "Fellas, guys, people, you know, this is not a close call. This law is clearly constitutional. It there's not even a question, and this whole lawsuit is really just ridiculous." And I would say in general, you know, there's sort of three kinds of people that I know who have studied this case. They're the ones who feel like it's a close call, but it's unconstitutional. They're the people who feel like it's a close call, but it's constitutional. And then they're the people who think it's a slam dunk, who think it shouldn't even be a question that it's constitutional. And frankly, the second two categories are a little bigger than the first.
And then there's probably a fourth group of people who say, you look at Bush v. Gore, and any predictions that constitutional scholars would have had in terms of the way that case was handled was also sort of was turned on its head. And who knows how the court's going to rule. So with that said, for the sake of time, we're not going to we'll talk about the necessary and proper clause aspect another time. But give me a sense of what happens if the court finds that this is unconstitutional, the Commerce Clause does not apply for whatever reason, that the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution does not apply in this instance. And what happens if they find that they can strike down the mandate, but it is severable from the rest of the law? What happens in that scenario? Because this puts a tremendous burden on private insurance at that point.
Sure, sure. Well, there's two questions about the severability. So, I mean, let's assume they throw out the mandate, but they leave the Medicaid expansion and they leave, you know, the cost-cutting stuff in Medicare. So they're just focusing on the mandate. They only throw out that part, which I think most people think if they do throw it out, that's what they'll do. One question is, do they throw out – the government has said if you throw out the mandate, you also have to throw out the part that tells insurance companies they have to give insurance to everybody, and, you know, they have to have community rating, and they have to have – they can't turn you down for a pre-existing condition. But it's actually possible the Supreme Court could say, well, we're going to throw out the mandate, but we're going to leave in those regulations. So, you know, you can't make people get insurance, but as far as we're concerned, you can still tell the insurance companies they have to sell to everybody regardless of pre-existing condition. Well, if that happens, then we get into the scenario you just described, and now the insurance companies are going to go into full-blown panic because they're going to say, uh-oh, this is exactly what we worried about. This is exactly why we need the mandate. And then, you know, at that point, this becomes an election issue even more than it is already. And, you know, the question is, does the next Congress come back? Let's assume that they don't have the votes to just repeal, you know, that either Obama wins or Democrats hold on to enough houses and seats in Congress. Do they then come up with some other way of fixing it? I mean, there are ways to change, to fix the mandate, to basically impose the mandate, but use different terms in the law. And I know that sounds silly, but quite honestly, you might just be able to redefine what's a tax and what's a penalty without actually changing the law. You know, that would probably work. Or they could try to come up with some alternative means. You know, you can have penalties for people who don't, you know, who enroll late in health insurance. There's a couple of ideas floating around about that. Some of those might work better than others. It's not clear. We don't know. But really, the bigger barrier would be political. You know, at that point, is Congress going to be willing to go back and do this?
Well, politically, it seems to me that the Republicans cannot put in a mandate light. I mean, it seems to me that their base will just don't have the political room to do that. That's what's so fascinating about this severability question, because on one hand, the government's the constitutionality of the government imposing regulations on insurance seems pretty well founded. I mean, it exists now. It's just that these regulations go further. The question of severability, it seems to me, will be a fairly technical one in terms of the intent of the law. But this could wreak real havoc. Let me ask you this. From the perspective of someone who, and I'm speaking for myself here, would love to see this evolve into a single-payer system, putting aside the merits of that for the moment, is that a potential outcome if the court finds it severable? Because I don't see how insurance companies, without sort of trying to really, I guess, massage these regulations on a state by state basis in the context of, I guess, of the exchanges on some level, how they can maintain their business model.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, look, I take a backseat to nobody in my enthusiasm for a single payer. I've always wanted to have a single payer plan in this country if we could, and I hope someday we do. Whether, you know, knocking out the mandate kind of leads to that inevitably, I think it's possible, but I think it would probably take a lot of time. I mean, I think you would see us playing around a lot with different regulations. They might try some kind of substitute. They might try to do it at the state level. There's so many unknowns at that. You know, the political the environment is so unknown. To what extent do insurers put pressure on their allies in the Republican Party to do something? And to what extent do the Republicans respond to that? And to what extent, you know, will they not be able to? It's just hard to know. My suspicion is if the mandate gets knocked out, but the other insurance regulations stay in place, you will see a muddling for a while. And, you know, they'll try to tinker with it because, you know, those regulations will probably do some good still. I mean, they will sort of make some difference, but not enough. And, you know, it'll be within, you know, for a few years they'll kind of work. And then after that, you'll see insurance premiums skyrocket. And that's going to then come back to the taxpayers. So I would think we'd muddle around for a long time before we finally got to a real answer. But, you know, who knows? I mean, it's really hard to predict.
What is the order in which they will deal with these questions? Do you know? Do we know at this point? In other words,
terms of the hearings?
Yeah, in other words, do they deal with, like, the question of severability first or last?
Oh, right. So, I'd have to look it up. I know that the mandate issue comes on the second day, on Tuesday. It's 3 days. I know the mandate is the second day. I think severability is the first day. Although it might be the third day, and I think the Medicaid expansion is also the third day. I think the first day might be this question about the standing issue and something called the Anti-Injunction Act. But I'm not 100% sure of that. But actually, you can go to the Supreme Court website. It's right up there. They have the schedule hearing.
And lastly, in the law professors that you've talked to about this, have they told you, is there something in particular, is there a specific justice? I mean, I guess... maybe the obvious answer is to watch Justice Kennedy. But do people generally feel that, you know, based on these oral arguments, and I guess they're going to be released via audio recording later in the day or just after the fact, is there something that people can divine from this process? Is there someone to be watching? Are there certain questions that may give a clue as to how this is going to play out?
Well, you know, I think oral arguments, sometimes the justices tip their hand, sometimes they don't. I do think what's interesting is I think the quick assumption everybody makes is, oh, this is all about Kennedy. And it might be. I mean, he might be the swing vote. But it's worth paying. I know there was a survey out, and actually, interestingly enough, the conservative justice that the survey thought was most likely to join the liberals was actually Chief Justice Roberts, for any number of reasons, based in part on a decision he was a majority, you know, in which he was recently the majority, based on a feeling of what, you know, how he'll want the court to be perceived on this particular, you know, this is not the issue. The conservative issues here don't seem to be issues he cares a lot about. I mean, he's a conservative activist, but not on this particular set of issues. He's much more worked up, let's say, about voting rights, and there are those cases coming up, so he might want to save his capital for those cases. Another guy to watch who might be interesting is Scalia. You know, he is the author of a concurring opinion a few years ago that is basically the closest, you know, I think the closest precedent we have to the mandate, in which, you know, if you follow the logic of what he wrote, it's almost, it's hard to imagine how somebody who wrote that concurrence could decide that the mandate was unconstitutional. Although, of course, we're talking about Scalia here, so who the heck knows.
Right.
But, you know, watch Scalia, you know, watch Kennedy, obviously, but watch Scalia, watch Roberts, watch Alito, even. I mean, it's not, the only one I think we know is hostile to this is Thomas. And we know we're pretty sure the four liberals are in favor of it. The other four conservatives, they're all, you know, there's a lot of unknowns around all of them.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating to watch this unfold. What do you think of the lastly? What do you think the chances are that we're going to get another one of these? We're just going to resolve this case. Don't look to this for precedent.
Oh God, I hope not. I mean, that was just embarrassing, right? I mean, that was just however the case turned out. I mean, I don't know about you. I just was sort of embarrassed, you know, to sort of, you know, as someone who, you know, sort of reveres American government and the Constitution. I just thought, oh God, John Marshall must be rolling over in his grave. So let's, you know, I think there might be a narrow decision. They might make a very narrow holding either way that tries very hard not to change constitutional doctrines. That's possible.
They won't throw out the whole case based upon the fact that you're not in a position to enjoin this from happening. In other words, they won't say there's really no standing here. They haven't taken us this far to say, you know, you guys got to come back after 2014 when this is an issue.
I would assume not, although, you know, maybe they get into negotiations and they're in a sort of deadlock and they kind of fall back on that at the end. I don't really know. I would have guessed not, right? I mean, they've, like you said, they've taken us this far. They've got 3 days of hearings. They've built it up. You know, if they were going to just duck the question, you would think, you know, by now they would have just said that right away. So I think they want to hear this case.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Jonathan Cohn, and folks, you can check out Jonathan's piece at The New Republic. We'll link to it at majority.fm, Obamacare on Trial, Case of the Century, ? Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on your show.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks, we got a couple more minutes here. Let me just there was one piece by Jeffrey Toobin that was fascinating on this accord, because all of the Supreme Court watchers, and Jeffrey Toobin's one of the most prominent ones, are beginning to look at this. We're already starting to see stories from the insurance company possibly freaking out. What would they do if the mandate itself is overturned and it's found to be severable from the rest of the act? But Jeffrey Toobin has an interesting piece about the three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit, which voted 2-1 to uphold the Obama's health care reform. That was the one which basically said, you know, the Commerce Clause, of course it is involved here, this notion that you are not part of economic activity that crosses state lines when you decide not to get health insurance is deluding yourself. And this is a fascinating concept, because it puts to lie this notion of libertarianism, of this idea of a free market, that somehow the market is something that you can affirmatively choose to engage in, or to somehow sequester yourself from it and live like you know, who's that famous hobo who lived up, you know, Robert Redford, what are they, Grizzly Adams, or whoever the guy is. That somehow you can live in your own sort of private Idaho where you're not in any way engaged in this. But the fact of the matter is that we are, all of us, by virtue of the fact that we're going to grow old and we're going to get sick, are participating in some fashion in the healthcare market, whether or not we're actually spending any money right now. And so there was one dissenter, a Judge Brett M. Kavanaugh. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals in 2003. He also was pretty famous for being one of the lead prose writers for the Star Report. He apparently came up with a quote, "On all nine of those occasions, the president fondled and kissed her bare breasts." And that, of course, that type of prose gets you onto a circuit court nomination. Anyways, Kavanaugh dissented on those grounds that this case is premature. There's no standing yet. You've not been subject to the penalties involved in the Affordable Care Act. Therefore, you have suffered no damages. Therefore, you cannot yet bring this case. But he goes on to write a 65-page opinion, which obviously was not just about the plaintiff's lack of standing here. He writes, "Under the Constitution, the president may decline to enforce a statute that regulates private individuals when the president deems the statute unconstitutional, even if a court has held or would hold the statute constitutional." You understand what that says? That even if a Supreme Court says that a law is constitutional, the president can decide unilaterally that, no, it's not. And therefore, I'm going to operate under that understanding that it's not constitutional. And so, now, Marbury v. Madison, which is a case from the early 1800s, 1805 maybe, I'm not sure, basically held that the Supreme Court adjudicates the law of the land and any question of constitutionality. So what Kavanaugh is suggesting here is beyond radical. It cuts against over 210 years of constitutional law in this country. And Tubin makes the point at the end of his piece that, understand that if President Santorum is President Santorum, a guy like Kavanaugh is probably the first on the list to go to the Supreme Court. You know, so when we talk about the distinction between a President Obama and a President Santorum, or perhaps a President Romney, as much as I agree with the proposition that most, if not all, the Supreme Court justices we have seen appointed over the past 50, 40 years have moved the court to the right on most issues. And as much as I agree with the notion that it's not hard to make the argument that the four so-called liberal judges on the Supreme Court are fairly corporatist in their views on the ever-narrowing spectrum of legitimate political thought in this country, the differences between a Supreme Court nominee from a President Obama and a Supreme Court nominee from a President Republican are fairly dramatic. In fact, just dramatic. Now, that may not be enough for you to vote for President Obama, and I have my days, but that's still one of the more prominent features of why, when I get into that booth alone, I mean, I'm in New York, so pretend for a moment I'm not. I would pull the lever for Obama. Still digging in to see how Rocky Anderson is doing with that Americans Elect thing. But that whole thing is fairly dubious enterprise in my estimation. However, with that said, Rocky Anderson's nomination by that Americans elect could change my attitude towards that. Folks, it's that time where we head to the better half, and I make an appeal to you. Come on. Come on. Become a Majority Report member today. It's a leaky ship we are steering here, folks. Very, very leaky. Oh, we're bailing as fast as we can. That onslaught of water that rushes through our hull on the good ship Majority Report, on the SS Sam Cedar. But we need your support, folks. Where else are you going to get this stuff from? Seriously. Where else? And then, if you can answer that question, tell me where else you're going to get this stuff with something like this.
Poopy, poopy, poop.
I would say nowhere. We just hit the cross tabs, folks. Are you going to get a 20-minute, 25-minute conversation breaking down the issues of the Affordable Care Act, and then a guy turning around going,
poopy, poopy, poop?
I don't think anywhere, in any language, in any country, in any continent, even if you have the ability to travel through time, I don't think you're going to find that. Now, maybe someday in the future, all political commentary will come with things like, you know.
What are you talking about?
Mom! 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 Why did you do that to me?
But until that day comes, you should support the Majority Report at majority.fm. It's cheap. It's good. It'll make you feel better about yourself. Of course, you can always use our Amazon link to buy your Amazon crap. You can find that under the support the show. JustCoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic, great tasting. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes.
Donate your account.
DonateYourAccount.com. Give us a call, 646-257-3920, as we head into the better half.